This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
Orthodox Radio Crusade. Anarchism for the global city. Radical environmentalism for the concrete jungle. Esoteric explorations of the secret history of rebel culture. The Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. Every Tuesday at midnight after the news, only on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. Be there.
No, never, no, never, the more a million say. And it's they who rule this American nation. They, boys, they.
Who shall rank as the family royal? Say, boys, say. If not those who are honest and loyal, say, boys, say. Then shall one elected as our servant, in his pride assume a regal sway. Must we bend to the human dictator? Say, boys, say.
No, never, no, never, the loyal million say. And it's they who rule this American nation, they, boys, they.
Shall we tarnish our national glory? Say, boys, say. Blot one line from the wonderful story. Say, boys, say. Did we vainly shed our blood in battle? Did our troops resultless win the day? Was our time and our treasure all squandered? Say, boys, say.
No, never, no, never, the loyal million say. And it's they who rule this American nation. They, boys, say.
All right, welcome aboard to the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade on listener-supported, non-commercial, WBAI 99.5 FM here in New York City, where it is now 6 minutes after midnight. And the music that we heard immediately after the news ended was some more of that wonderful group Kenge Kenge, traditional Luo music from Kenya. And then the song that we heard after that, with the cart introducing the show at midnight between the two, that was a protest song from 1866, the year after Lincoln was assassinated, by entitled "Who Shall Rule This American Nation?" by Henry Clay Work, who, despite obviously being named after Henry Clay, the author of the Missouri Compromise, was an abolitionist and a supporter of Lincoln and the Republican Party, which meant an opponent of the Missouri Compromise and an opponent of the extension of slavery into the Western Territories, anywhere in the Western Territories. And that song was actually written, so it was sort of a protest song against Andrew Johnson, who, the vice president who assumed power upon Lincoln's assassination and who represented a real step backwards in terms of Reconstruction and dismantling the remnants of the deposed Slavocracy in the South. He represented a big step backwards and was widely seen by the radical Reconstructionists of the day as betraying everything which had been fought for the last four brutal, bloody years, and having capitulated to the Slavocracy. And that was a lot of contestation during his presidency. And finally, of course, things got somewhat back on track when he was succeeded by Ulysses Grant. And then, of course, the sleazy backroom deal that put Rutherford B. Hayes in office after that, as we discussed last week. Finally, that was the end of Reconstruction and the beginning of Klan terror and Jim Crow in the South, and the birth of the Republican Party that we know and love today. So, obviously we're going to be continuing with the discussion that we began last week, sort of riffing off of the whole inevitable Lincoln-Obama analogy. And I did a lot of ranting last week. I wanted to get the phone calls and didn't. So tonight, I promise you, we're going to get the phone calls. In fact, we're going to take, if everything goes according to plan, we're going to take a solid hour of phone calls and see what all of you have to say. Because I've been listening to WBAI for the past week since the inauguration. And, the producers seem to be sort of divided between bubbly enthusiasm on one hand and, playing Obama's victory speech and inaugural speech over and over again with various musical backgrounds. And on the other hand, you know, this real sort of hard-bitten, lefter-than-thou, cynical attitude of, oh, nothing's changed, they're all the same, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I have to say that I see myself somewhere along the spectrum between these two extremes. I really do. I don't think it's fair to say that nothing has changed. That's a huge overstatement. And I have to say, for the first 24 hours after the inauguration, I just couldn't wipe the big stupid grin off my face. And then, just the day after the inauguration, there was another CIA drone attack on Pakistan, which a couple of CIA drone attacks on Pakistan, as a matter of fact. Not only did, well, there were two strikes actually, both in the tribal territories on the border with Afghanistan, then where, you know, the CIA has been doing drone attacks targeting suspected militant leaders almost every week for the past 6 months. They've jacked up an incredible toll of collateral damage, civilian casualties. And so did these. There were two villages which were targeted, like around two or three missile strikes each in two villages which were targeted a week ago tomorrow. In one, it looked like they really did get some baddie, some Al-Qaeda type, or some, you know, local Taliban militia commander type. And it seems like the other one, judging by the news accounts from Pakistan, the people who were on the ground, it looks like the other one was just bad information, and they just wiped out a bunch of people who just happened to be there. And in fact, one of them was, yes, he was a tribal elder, and he had his own militia, as, you know, all the tribal leaders do in that part of Pakistan. But this was a pro-government tribal leader. So here we are, you know, we, using that pronoun, which I don't like to use when I talk about the government. Here is the government, you know, wiping out our own allies, so to speak. So they actually wiped out a pro-government tribal militia commander, as opposed to one of the baddies. So, you know, way to make friends and influence people, eh? You know, to wipe out your own side. Really good. And then the day after that, there was another airstrike. This time, U.S. military, as opposed to the CIA, and actually carried out with warplanes rather than a drone, in Pakistan, which once again, you know, U.S. and NATO forces are saying that there were 15 people dead and they were all Taliban militants. And the local people there are saying, well, actually, no, it was more than 20 people dead and there weren't any Taliban here. It was just, you know, a bunch of goat herders who you wiped out. So this is not good. This is very bad. I shouldn't say that it's too surprising, because unfortunately it's really not very surprising, because Obama really never gave us any indication that he was going to de-escalate things in Afghanistan. On the contrary, he made quite clear that he was going to escalate things in Afghanistan. Still, you know, he did actually make some noises on the campaign trail. And actually took a lot of grief for it from Sarah Palin, who used it to portray him as unpatriotic. He did make some noises on the campaign trail about the less than fastidiously targeted airstrike, shall we say. And in his own words here, let's see, can I actually call up the quote here? In his own words, he protested, quote, air raiding villages and killing civilians, which is causing enormous problems over there. So, and he was, you know, baited for saying this by Sarah Palin, as if this made him unpatriotic or whatever. So, disturbing that apparently it seems the same pattern is continuing. Now, back several months ago, Bush signed an executive order, which was secret and was reported in the New York Times many months after the fact, just recently,
which gave the military authority, gave the CIA, actually, authority to carry out these drone strikes in Pakistan's tribal territories along the border with Afghanistan at will, when they have intelligence that, you know, they've got some baddie in their coordinates for a targeted assassination, that they can go ahead and do it at will. Despite the fact that, you know, there's been this tremendous toll in civilian casualties, and despite the fact that, you know, the Pakistani government, our supposed allies, have been protesting this. I mean, it's just like, you know, a real humiliation for Pakistan. It's like, oh, this is what we think of, you know, our wonderful allies in the global war on terrorism, that we're going to keep on bombing your territory without your permission and over your protests. So the Pakistani government has protested this over and over and over again, you know, lodging formal, diplomatic, very strongly worded protests, and the U.S. has just been ignoring them and continuing to do it. So, all right, so I had hoped that that maybe Obama just never got around or hadn't gotten around yet to turning off that executive order that Bush signed, allowing the CIA to go ahead and do this kind of thing. But judging from Defense Secretary Robert Gates's testimony today before Congress, it doesn't look like that's the case. It looks like this is actually going to be a continuance of the same policy. He explicitly stated that the missile attacks on Pakistan are going to continue, and yes, we're going to be sending over several new brigades to Afghanistan on short order. So this is very discouraging, but like I say, you know, I never should have cultivated any illusions that anything other than this was going to happen, because Obama was pretty explicit that that he actually supported this policy and intended to escalate things in Afghanistan, and also to, I mean, he stated explicitly on the campaign trail that he would continue bombing Pakistan, even unilaterally, without the government's permission. So I was hoping maybe that was just lip service, but thus far, first week, proving otherwise. Now, some of the other Bush executive orders, which he has overturned, well, there's been at least some tentative good news on that front. Of course, most famously, the one calling for a halt to the Guantanamo tribunals. Calling for the CIA to adhere to military regulations on interrogation pending a review of both of these things, pending a review of the military tribunals and the coercive interrogation methods, quote unquote, which is, of course, a euphemism for torture, as we all understand. So this is, I would say, tentatively good news. Big step in the right direction, but let's see what comes of it, because he's only ordered a review of these policies. So, you know, we'll really be able to judge how meaningful this is a few weeks or a few months down the line. But certainly, big step in the right direction, and it's encouraging that he got around to it fairly immediately, right? As soon as he took office, he got around to dealing with this. Then, let's see, there was the other, also a sort of a mixed bag. Good that he got around to it as fast as he did, but not as sweeping as they could have been, were the executive orders which he signed, again, overturning the executive orders which Bush had signed, which had opened up public land and offshore zones to the oil companies and so on. That was, he didn't overturn as much as the environmentalists had been hoping that he would, but nonetheless, a big step in the right direction at least, and maybe he'll go further. Let's see. And finally, yesterday, he directed the EPA to reconsider the Bush administration position on auto emissions, potentially allowing California and now Vermont and several other states to instate their own standards on auto emissions, which go beyond those of the Environmental Protection Agency. So, once again, we'll see what comes of it. Big step in the right direction, but we'll see what comes of it. Because, once again, he's merely ordering the EPA to reconsider the Bush policy. So, good that he signed all this in the first week, but now let's see what kind of new policies emerge from overturning the old Bush policies. So, we're going to continue to watch this all very, very closely, but I'm most disturbed by the apparent continuance of the bellicose policy in Pakistan and Afghanistan. You know, I've got more to say about all of this. I'm going to say a little bit more, but first, Before we do that and move into taking phone calls, which I hope that we'll do in about 10 minutes or so, let me remind people about the one event which I want to announce, which is coming up this weekend, which is the Libertarian Book Club Anarchist Forum. A big, big, big thank you to the listener who called in when I announced it last week and told me that, in fact, it's going to be happening at 2 in the afternoon on Saturday. And that is the case. It's going to be happening at 2 in the afternoon on Saturday. It'll be the first time that we being the Libertarian Book Club, have held our Anarchist Forum on a Saturday and in the afternoon. So that's what threw me. Usually we hold them on Tuesdays in the evening. But this time it's going to be Saturday in the afternoon. So it seems that our host, the Living Theater, has been throwing us some scheduling changes. So hopefully we'll be able to adapt. 2 in the afternoon is a little bit early in the day for me, but I hope to be there to hear Osha Newman, the fighting radical attorney of Berkeley, California, speaking about his new book, which is a memoir of his youthful indiscretions, shall we say, with the Lower East Side sort of a street fighting anarchist gang of the late 1960s, euphemistically known as the up against the wall mother freakers. So if you ever wanted to know about the secret history of the up against the wall mother freakers and trying how they tried to carve out an autonomous zone for themselves in the Lower East Side, taking over buildings and establishing community gardens and doing all these radical art projects and fighting the police quite a great deal, I believe. This will be your opportunity to hear all about it. So once again, join us for the January Anarchist Forum, Osha Newman speaking about his new book on the history of the up-against-the-wall mother freakers. Hopefully his new book is going to be there, because I really want to see it. I haven't seen it yet. I want to get a copy and read it. Unfortunately, I don't believe that Osha will be around on a Tuesday night. I believe he's going back out to California before next Tuesday, so I won't be able to get him on the radio. So if you want to hear what he has to say, this is going to be your one opportunity. So once again, this is going to be this Saturday, January 31st at 2 in the afternoon. Where, you might ask? Well, I'll tell you. It's going to be at the Living Theater, which is 21 Clinton Street on the Lower East Side, south of Houston, if you're coming from uptown, or half a block south of Houston, if you're coming from uptown, and you took the F train and got off at Houston Street, or that is 2nd Avenue and Houston Street, or a block and a half north of Delancey if you got off at Delancey Street Station, also on the F. So that's where it is, 21 Clinton Street on the Lower East Side, south of Houston, half a block south of Houston, or a block and a half north of Delancey. Be there. That's the one. Once again, Osha Newman speaking about his new memoir of his days with the 1960s Lower East Side radical group, the Up Against the Wall Mother Freakers, so to speak, at the Living Theater, 21 Clinton Street, this Saturday, January 31st, 2 p.m. I'm going to be there. You should be there, too. If you missed any of this information, well, it's all on our website. Go to morc.info. That's M-O-R-C for Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade .info. Go to the links page and click on the Libertarian Book Club Anarchist Forum. And let's see. With that, I'll tell you what. Why don't we play a little bit more of Kenge Kenge. And then, you know, one of the readings which I gave last week, I need to revisit, because that's really what I wanted to use as a springboard for taking phone calls. So it's a short reading, but I'm going to do it again and give just a little bit of a wrap. And then we're going to take your listener phone calls, hopefully for the full last hour of the show. 212-209-2900 is the number, and let's hear a little bit more of Kenge Kenge, and then I'll just give a little bit more of a rap, and then we'll see what you all have to say. Let's see, which cut do I want to hear? Let's hear cut 4, shall we? Yes.
Oh,
Those Luo can rock, eh? Once again, that is Kenge Kenge, traditional Luo music from Kenya. They're the hot outfit right now. And, of course, they did an homage in song to Obama, which got a lot of airplay in Kenya, I understand, and we played last week. This is from their album Introducing Kenge Kenge from the African Living Traditions series on the World Music Network label. Okay, let's see. Did I give a station break? I'll give one now just in case. It's 12:35 in the morning on listener-supported non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM here in New York City. My name is Bill Weinberg, and the name of this show is, for somewhat obscure reasons, the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. We're going to take your phone calls shortly at 212-209-2900, 212-209-2900, shortly. Well, let's see. Obviously, given the whole entirely too lengthy exegesis that I ranted on and on about last week on the whole Obama-Lincoln analogy, which Obama has certainly played very, very, very blatantly. One of my questions was, you know, I was trying to make the point that, you know, Lincoln was, I mean, greatness was sort of thrust upon Lincoln by historical circumstance. He did not start out as an abolitionist. When he came into office, he had no intention of doing away with slavery. And in his first inaugural, when the southern states were beginning to secede by that point, you know, he did all he could to try to assure them, you have nothing to worry about, stick with the Union, I'm not posing any threat to the slave system, only to its expansion. And then as the war ground on, and it became clearer that the perpetuation of the slave system was in fact at the root of the war, he was sort of won over to the abolitionist position. And Frederick Douglass, who had initially been very, very harshly critical of Lincoln, was by his second term won over and became a supporter, continuing to try to pressure him more towards an abolitionist position and more towards a real hardcore intransigent position in terms of dealing with the South and Reconstruction. But nonetheless, a supporter. So one of my questions is, what is the what are the odds that Obama is going to be radicalized in office by historical circumstance? And this, of course, is related to the question of whether this economic crisis is beginning or ending. Are we on the brink of something which is much, much bigger than it has been thus far? Or are we back from the edge? I think, you know, how the degree to which Obama is radicalized in office may depend on this, on the answer to this question. But what do you all think? Is the potential there? And what might that look like? And finally, by way of analogy, just as Frederick Douglass, having initially started out as a harsh critic of Lincoln, was brought around by his re-election in 1865 by the fact that, once again, Lincoln had been radicalized by historical circumstance. Here's the other quote which I read, which was from the great Italian-American anarchist Carlo Tresca, one of my personal heroes, who similarly came around by the re-election of Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1940. Reading from the book, once again, All the Right Enemies, The Life and Murder of Carlo Tresca by Dorothy Gallagher. Wonderful book. In the fall of 1940, Tresca dropped his opposition to Roosevelt. In 1934, he had written of Roosevelt as, quote, an industrial and social dictator whose attempts at reforms served to preserve the failing capitalist system. But in the 1940 issue, a November 14th, 1940 issue of the New York-based Italian-language anarchist journal Il Martello, The Hammer, which Carlo Tresca edited, he wrote the following. And this is what I'm going to sort of use as a springboard for a discussion here. Quote, Roosevelt has been reelected by a large majority. It's all the same to us, the distinguished revolutionist will say. It's all the same to us, will say those who delight in dulling their minds by a constant repetition of the sacred principles. To me, it does make a difference. Wendell Willkie's election, being the Republican candidate who opposed Roosevelt and the New Deal, and pro-isolationist, didn't want the U.S. to get involved in the struggle against fascism. Wilkie's election would have frozen my blood. Roosevelt's warmed it up. I say this in all frankness and sincerity, because in these times to hide one's emotions is hypocrisy. I am not a hypocrite. I immediately thought that Roosevelt's re-election would be regarded by the whole world as a moral and material defeat for the Axis. As it is my belief in this tragic hour that the most important task of the human race is to strike a death blow to Nazism and fascism, I do fervently hope that a crushing defeat will be inflicted on Hitler, Mussolini, and Stalin. And once again, he includes Stalin in this formulation because this is November 1940 when the Hitler-Stalin pact was still on. To continue with Carlo Tresca, reason tells us that this is an imperialist war. Sentiment impels us to preference one of the fighting camps. Come, in this hour so utterly bestial, so somber and threatening, there is no need to confine our emotions in the straitjacket of dogmas, doctrines, and immutable principles. And once again, you know, I read this quote because it sums up exactly what I've been feeling since Obama's re-election. And so this is my second question. My second question, which I pose to the listeners tonight, is even those of you who, you know, adhere to, you know, a hardcore abstentionist position, anti-electoral position, and recognize that there can't be any fundamental change from within the system or from the, you know, dominant bourgeois political parties, the Democrats and the Republicans. Nonetheless, will you, some of you, acknowledge that there has been, that you have been sharing, shall we say, in the general feeling of elation since Obama's election? And okay, after his election, I was sort of waiting for the other boot to drop because I thought that the Bushites were going to instrument some kind of terrible crisis in the couple of months remaining to them. But they didn't do that. I think they've just been utterly and utterly and utterly defeated, demoralized, and broken as a political force. The whole neoconservative and neoliberal right, so to speak, have just been broken. And that was, it was sort of the, I mean, that was really what defined the, those are sort of the two pillars, along with the grassroots, religious or culturally conservative right, three pillars, shall we say, of the Bush coalition. You know, on one hand, you had the, electoral cannon fodder of the, cultural conservative and religious right. And then, in terms of the alliance of, power brokers and people in the corridors of power, who came together, it was the neoliberal right and the neoconservative right. And what I mean by that, using the word neoliberal in the sense which it's used in the rest of the world outside the United States of America, where liberal means the opposite of what it means here. It means, you know, classical 19th century liberalism, laissez-faire capitalism, let the pigs run wild, no regulation, the free market will take care of everything. The corporate right, so to speak, with the neoconservative right, which are, you know, these wonks from the think tanks, like the Project for a New American Century and so on, who have got these really hubristic visions of just completely remaking the entire world order, particularly the Middle East, and overthrowing just about all of the Arab regimes in their most hubristic fantasies before they were taken down a peg or two by things going south in Iraq. So, okay, this whole coalition, I think, is just that they've been shattered by the events of the past several months. And even if there isn't going to be any fundamental change for the better, and the basic consensus of corporate rule and global military crusades are going to remain intact under the Obama administration, at least it's a less hubristic and bellicose and dogmatic wing of the ruling elites. And maybe there will be a little bit more elbow room for freedom and ability to fight back under Obama than there was under Bush, where it just felt like we were getting clobbered on so many fronts simultaneously that, it's been nothing but lost ground since Reagan. You know, there were a couple of moments there since the beginning of the Reagan Revolution where I felt like, things were sort of turning around for the better. One was the Zapatista Revolution in Mexico in 1994. And then really as a direct result of that, that was sort of the beginning of what later sort of became the anti-globalization movement. Taking its really, you can say there was a direct inspiration going back to the Chiapas revolt. So that sort of led right up to the 1999 protests in Seattle, when we really felt like, we're starting to gain some momentum here. We're at least starting to slow down the whole process of corporate globalization, and it's a real upsurge from below. So, all right, now I don't feel now that we're really witnessing, a real sort of radical upsurge from below like the Chiapas Revolt or the anti-globalization movement represented, no. But I do feel that maybe, in fact, what we've, even though it hasn't got that same kind of, genuine grassroots populist thrust, maybe what we're witnessing now is in some ways more important. Because it seems that, the dogmas of the Reagan Revolution have now really been overturned. So, all right, so that's my second question is, will you, some of you acknowledge, even if you don't, place any great hopes or aspirations on Obama, will you at least acknowledge your own feelings of relief and even elation, and examine those feelings? Is this merely the siren song of illusion? Or might your reasons actually be founded on some legitimate, intuitive understanding of what's going on in the world, which your rational, dogmatic, straitjacketed superego has failed to thus far accept? That's my second question. And my third question, relates particularly to the historical context of the Carlo Tresca quote that I just read and the struggle against fascism. I've gone on longer than I anticipated, but I really am about to wrap it up. So when I read that quote last time, I immediately made the point that, yes, this was exactly how I've been feeling since Obama's election. And then I made the point, just because it happens to be a particular be in my bonnet, and something which is particularly an issue which is very, very close to my heart, is that Obama has got a brain and he's literate, whereas the outgoing guy couldn't even put a coherent sentence together. And Obama knows how to write. Not only does he know how to talk, he knows how to write. And his book, his memoir, which was written long before he was running for president, right? So Dreams from My Father, it's really quite a good book. I mean, I didn't read The Audacity of Hope because that just seemed like the kind of, de rigueur book that everybody who's running for president has got to write. My Vision for America, blah, blah, blah. But Dreams from My Father, which is a memoir and has a lot to say about, race in America and the complexities of multiculturalism, is really quite a good book. And it was obviously not ghostwritten. It was really written, and it's really, written by Obama, and it's written from the heart. So, but anyway, that's and sort of a subsidiary point to the one that I wanted to make. And, I really, of course, it's related to politics, as I said, invoking Orwell, although I got the formulation a little bit wrong when I invoked Orwell, because what I actually said is that if you can't read, you can't think. And that really isn't quite right. I do believe that you can be illiterate and perfectly capable of critical reasoning. Actually, what Orwell said was that sloppy language equals sloppy thought, to correct my interpretation of Orwell. That's actually what he said in his essay, Politics in the English Language. So, and that's really the more important point regarding the whole point about Obama being literate. The whole degradation of the English language has actually got political implications. And certainly the English language was very, very much degraded from the bully pulpit of the White House under Bush. But that really wasn't even the point I intended to make. The point that I intended to make was, I mean, okay, Carlo Tresca was elated by Roosevelt's reelection in 1940 because of the struggle, what it implied for the struggle against fascism. Well, obviously, we're not going to take an hour of phone calls, but I promise we will take a half hour of phone calls or more, okay? I really am wrapping it up. All right, so obviously, there isn't any Axis on the landscape today, okay? And people would argue that fascism is not relevant to the contemporary world situation. But, in fact, all of the rhetoric for and against the Iraq War and the global war on terrorism generally has invoked fascism, all right? Bush talked about so-called Islamo-fascism and the notion that, Islamic extremism is the new fascism and we have to stand up to it just like we had to stand up to at the Hitler, blah, 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 blah. And then, you know, a lot of the anti-Bush rhetoric was also, you know, throwing around fascism as an insult, just sort of like throwing it around like a manhole cover. And, you know, the neocons are really neo-Nazis and blah, 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 blah. Okay, well, there is both of these epithets, right? Islamo-fascism and the neocons are neo-Nazis. Both of them are really off base and missing some very, very critical distinctions. But there's also an element of truth to them. You know, I mean, all effective propaganda has got to have an element of truth. And so this is why the whole thing was sort of, you know, the pot calling the kettle black. All right. Now, hopefully I don't have to elaborate on the differences between Islamist extremism, you know, the jihad, so to speak, whatever you want to call it, and fascism. I mean, the differences should be pretty obvious. But there are also, and if people don't get the differences, well, you can call in and tell me, and I'll explain them to you. But there are also similarities which we shouldn't overlook, right? I mean, certainly the complete rejection of the West and democracy and the liberal tradition and the fanatical hatred of Jews. You know, there are points of similarity here. Otherwise, the analogy couldn't have been made, and it wouldn't have made for effective propaganda. And similarly, even though there are obvious distinctions between the neocons and classical fascism, which once again I hope I don't have to elaborate on. I hope that the audience is sophisticated enough to understand the differences. I mean, for one thing, the neocons did everything that they ever did in the rhetoric of expanding democracy. And, you know, the classical fascists were completely, you know, in opposition to democracy and the liberal tradition and the West. So that's an obvious difference, right? nonetheless, once again, it wouldn't have made effective propaganda if there wasn't an element of truth to it. And, you know, in fact, the whole hubristic vision of remaking the world in our image and the whole fetish for aggressive warfare and the whole notion of, American exceptionalism, and we're, you know, above the Geneva Conventions and the rules of law and so on. All of that, you know, actually is redolent of classical fascism. So, you know, both of these elements here, you know, is kind of like the pot calling the kettle black. So there actually is, I would argue, something akin to fascism alive in the world today. Not classical fascism, such as it existed between 1922 and 1945, but something which is disturbingly redolent of it. And it exists on both sides of the whole demoralizing jihad versus GWAT paradigm, which we've seen unfolding since 9/11. GWAT, of course, being the global war on terrorism. And, you know, the title of Tariq Ali's book, Clash of Fundamentalisms, is very instructive, and even more so is the catchphrase of the civil resistance in Iraq, which rejects both U.S. imperialism and the, you know, so-called insurgents and the Islamists. And they say that it's, you know, that they're between two poles of terrorism. You've got the state terrorism of U.S. imperialism, and you've got the insurgent terrorism of the Jihad. And they sort of mirror each other in terms of, you know, terrorizing the people of Iraq and using terror as a political tool to achieve their domination. So my third and final question is, might not the election of Obama at least represent a break in that dynamic? And even if the election of Obama isn't wholly responsible for it, might it not be a part of, an integral part of, finally a break in that dynamic? And I look at everything that's been happening around the world in recent weeks. And yes, there have been some horrible things which really fit into the whole GWAT versus Jihad dynamic, such as the Mumbai attacks. But there's been an awful lot which has not fit into that dynamic, such as the uprising, which is really still underway in Greece, and the similar, smaller scale, but still quite impressive econo riots, so to speak, uprisings which have broken out over deteriorating economic conditions, really all across Europe, from the Baltics to Iceland, in Latvia and Lithuania, Bulgaria, France, and Iceland, just the examples which come to mind. And the uprising which we just witnessed in Oakland, California, a couple of weeks ago, over that horrific police slaying there by the transit police there in the Bay Area. This is something different. Okay, this is even if it's not, you know, adhering to any strict nonviolence code, so to say the very least. You know, and there has been, you know, a certain amount of throwing Molotov cocktails around and stuff like that, especially in Greece. Still, this is, you know, it's more on the Intifada model than the Al-Qaeda model, so to speak, right? It's actually been something which has, once again, had some real populist grassroots content to it and has been coming from the left, not from some kind of religious fundamentalism, some kind of, you know, deep cultural conservatism. And, you know, it hasn't been terrorism. It's been real popular uprisings. So maybe there's finally been a break in this, you know, Jihad versus GWAT dynamic. And maybe there's, you know, the potential for class struggle to reemerge without being, you know, without all of the popular rage which is out there being siphoned off into, you know, evil totalitarian ideologies. So, there, that's my third question, is might there not be finally, you know, a break in this dynamic? And, and I'm even going to venture, okay, in the 1 minute remaining to us, and this I do think is a siren song, but nonetheless, I'm going to throw it out there anyway, okay, just to see if anybody thinks it. I'm not saying that I think it, okay? I just want to see if anybody else out there thinks that maybe, having broken with the religious right, although, you know, given the whole brouhaha over the fundamentalist preacher who did the invocation at the inauguration, maybe Obama hasn't really broken with the fundamentalist religious right all that much. Maybe he hasn't so thoroughly kicked them overboard as some might hope. But there were also, you know, his whole invocation in his inauguration of non-believers, as well as Christians and Jews and Muslims and Hindus, and saying that we're going to restore science to its rightful place. These are all signs. These are all good signs. So, maybe, having broken with the neocons and broken with the religious right, maybe Obama has got the moral legitimacy to carry out a war on terror that progressives will get behind, just as Carlo Tresca got behind FDR's war effort. Does anybody else think so? I shouldn't say anybody else, because I don't think so. I'm not ready to go there by any means. But I'm wondering if some of you, I'm just throwing it out for consideration. Okay, now, it's 1 minute after, all right, it's only going to be a half hour of phone calls, but it's going to be a full half hour of phone calls. It's 1 minute after one in the morning on listener-supported, non-commercial, WBAI, 99.5 FM in New York City. This is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade, and you are on the air. No, you're not. The number, by the way, is 212-209-2900, 212-209-2900. WBAI, you're on the air. Okay. Third time's a charm, right? WBAI, you're on the air. Maybe the third time isn't the charm after all. WBAI, you're on the air. Well, I think we might have to go back to Kenge Kenge, or me ranting. WBAI, you're on the air. Turn down your radio, please. Turn down your radio.
Hey, maybe the fifth.
Yeah, maybe fifth time will be a charm. Lay it on me.
If it was the fourth, it would have been Hegelian, but that's...
Oh?
Well, you know, the fourth, you know, you have thesis and antithesis and then synthesis. That's the third.
Oh, right. So what's the fourth?
Nothingness.
Oh, okay.
Being a nothingness.
Gotcha.
Anyway, you toss out so much stuff. It's this whole Obama thing. Gramsci had a short piece on American intelligentsia. He wrote this back in the 30s, you know. This Italian guy?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. It's pretty, when you mentioned Obama, the first thing that came to my mind was like, I should read that again. It was.
All right, so what does he have to say?
Well, I thought of it, but, it's sort of a, from what I, sort of a, he tries to be anthropological, kind of, he says, he basically says it's very minuscule, but it's very powerful. It's almost, you know, compared to the best of the Europeans, so. It makes sense, you know, Tom Paine and all that, you know, all that Republican legacy from England and France, you know, obviously.
I think standards have been very, very deeply dumbed down in the last generation or so.
Absolutely. But the Reconstruction song that you started with, that was very good, actually.
I might go out with it again.
A Jewish temple with that name, right?
I'm sorry?
There's a Jewish temple with that name?
Oh, yes. There's a school of Judaism, the Reconstructionists. Yes, right. They're a more recent development than the Orthodox, Conservative, and Reform. They emerged, I think, within the last generation or so, the Reconstructionists. Yeah, they sort of see themselves as... getting back more towards tradition. So they would be a little bit more traditional than the Reform, but also they tend to be politically progressive and not rigidly doctrinaire like the Orthodox. Yeah.
Yeah, well in the American history context, you know, obviously.
Right. I think that's probably a coincidence, but it's an interesting correlation.
American Judaism, right?
Yeah, it is American, yeah. I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
So these the mofos you were mentioning for Saturday?
Yes.
They're actually the beside them that there used to be also this other group back in the 60s in Berkeley, you know, in Bay Area.
Yeah.
They call them the Persian mofos, right?
really?
Yeah, so what they would do, they would go to all these protests and stuff. You know, I wasn't there, but I heard the stories from more than one people. That they would go with these, you know, these teapots, these actually you know, the what they call the samovar, the tea machine.
Uh-huh.
Or the Russian thing.
Yeah.
And they would serve, you know, people tea.
Oh, wow, great. We should revive this tradition.
So they would call the Persian mobiles out here, you know.
Ah, terrific. All right, let's see if we can squeeze in some more phone calls. Maybe you'll bring some Persian tea to the Anarchist Forum on Saturday.
Judson, the Republic workers are there, actually.
I'm sorry?
I was going to invite you and the audience to Judson Saturday.
Oh, yeah? What's going on?
These are the people who took over the factories in Chicago.
Oh, really? They're going to be speaking at Judson Church on Saturday?
Yeah, man.
What time?
Same time as...
No, really?
As the mofos.
Yeah. Oh, well, you're going to have to make your choice then.
You should invite the guy for the mofos to the program.
I know, but I can't. He's not going to be in town on a Tuesday, unfortunately.
Oh, recording, you know.
Yeah, well, I'll do something. Don't worry. Well, anyway, maybe you can give us a report back on the Chicago workers at Judson, and I'll give a report back on the mother freakers at the Anarchist Forum. Let's see if we can take another call.
All right, man.
Thank you very much.
All right.
WBAI, you're on the air. You're on the air. Please turn down your radio and speak up.
Give me a little break.
Excuse me?
Make my double pasteurized milkshake, bartender, with a Swami yogurt shaker.
No kidding?
Do you have anything to say? Maybe not. WBAI, you're on the air. Oh, yeah. I love listening to that dial tone. It really makes for exciting radio, listening to dial tones. Oh, and then there's this fellow. So, do you enjoy being a moron? I was just wondering. Do you make a conscious decision to become a moron at some point in your life, or do you feel that you were born a moron? Doesn't seem to be particularly articulate. WBAI, you're on the air. He's still there? No. Turn down your radio.
Oh, hello, hello. How are you?
Hi.
Listen, all right. It's a hard act to follow. Maybe it's not that hard. Listen, there was a recent Supreme Court decision, you know, like on the highway, if a police officer stops you, you know, like for going through a sign or speeding, they can say they reasonably suspect somebody and frisk everybody in the car.
I'm aware of this. What does it do with what we're talking about?
Well, but a couple of other people, well, I just came in the house, as a matter of fact. Well, can I just get a say something about people don't seem to understand that, like, when you go through the turnstile without paying, all right, but that gives the police a chance to search for weapons and to find out if there are any warrants on you.
We know this.
Well, a lot of people aren't aware of it. Well, why you pick a... You know,
what is this that we're talking about? I mean,
what were you? Well, let me ask you this.
Oh, wait a minute, wait a minute. What was I talking about? Why don't you listen to the radio show? WBAI, you're on the air.
Wait a minute.
Turn down your radio, please.
Yep.
Hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Okay. You're on the air.
Oh, great. Sorry, buddy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you were speaking of Obama and his speech and how moved you were with his speech. For me, I'm involved with what's called the Campaign for Liberty, and I've been involved for the last 2 years, and that's kind of the forefront of Ron Paul's general philosophies and unbiased, if you will, unbiased position.
Wait a minute. You think that Ron Paul is an unbiased position?
In regards of today's Republican/Democrat? Absolutely.
Unbiased? What on earth do you mean by unbiased? He's got a political position just like everybody else. He's not unbiased. He's a politician.
Well,
I mean, you can say that a journalist is unbiased, but a politician? How can a politician be unbiased? He's got a program. He's got a position. What are you talking about?
Well, he feels he's for America.
Oh, so. He's for America. Well, gee, that's a relief. I thought he might have been for Mongolia or Paraguay, perhaps.
The neocons and the Democrats in today's age, in 2009, the Republicrats, are not for America.
Oh, what are they for?
They're for a general world overseeing population.
Uh-oh, the New World Order. Well, they say that they're for America, so why should I believe Ron Paul as opposed to believing them?
Well, number one, he wants to bring all 700 bases down to a close, 700 bases around, 146 countries of the world. He wants to shut all the bases and bring all of these troops home, remedying a massive portion of the debt that we're in right now due to the Federal Reserve. So that's for America. That's not overextending into Israel. That's not overextending into Africa. That's not overextending into the Far East. This is bringing American troops home and leaving foreign countries. To me, that's an unbiased view of strengthening America.
Well, you know, I mean, the thing is that Ron Paul, in my opinion, manages to sucker in the gullible by taking, you know, fairly radical stances on such issues and, you know, opposing the Iraq war forthrightly and supporting drug legalization and all that sort of thing. But unfortunately, he's a right-wing whack job. I mean, how do you feel about all of the really abhorrent stuff which appeared in his newsletter, Ron Paul Political Report, over the past, like, 25 years or so since he's been in Congress, calling for, you know, preparing for the race riot and your, you know, right to... Here, I've actually got some of the quotes in front of me here. This is from the Ron Paul Political Report after the Los Angeles riots of 1992. Quote, order was only restored in L.A. when it was time for the blacks to pick up their welfare checks 3 days after the rioting began. What if the checks had never arrived? No doubt the blacks would have fully privatized the welfare state through continued looting. But they were paid off and the violence subsided. And let's see, there's... see if there's some other real choice ones here. Let's see. Oh, yeah, right. Then if you have to use your gun on a youth, you should leave the scene immediately, disposing of the wiped-off gun as soon as possible. Such a gun cannot, of course, be registered to you, but one bought privately through the classifieds, for example. So here he is providing, this is also after the L.A. riots in 1992, providing practical information for shooting youth. What do you have to say about all this?
Well, these are quotes that I haven't read.
Well, I have read them.
Right. Well, they're also quotes. I mean, you're...
Yes, exactly. They're quotes from your hero, Ron Paul. They appeared in his newsletter under his name.
You seem to be overtly impressed by Obama's latest speech and also in his inauguration speech.
I'm extremely critical of much of Obama, as you are much aware, but you're changing the subject. I ask you a question, you're dodging the answer.
No, you're asking me a question on a quote that I haven't heard, nor have I read.
Well, I suggest you do your homework. We're going to move on. WBAI, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, I'm Tom from the Bronx here, and I'd just like to say this. Since this country's beginnings, the United States has created five countries in the world that never existed before the United States existed.
Well, Panama.
Well, okay. Wait a minute. I'm gonna call them off.
Name the other four. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It was okay. Here we go. A little repetitive there. Liberia, which was the least successful. Panama, financially successful. Taiwan, financially successful.
No, I'm not so sure.
South Korea.
No, I'm not so sure.
Well, no. Meaning that it's still generated money for the people of
I'm
the
I'm not
top.
Sure I would include Taiwan as having been created by the United States, but keep
well,
going.
Wait a minute. It was formerly Formosa, but it became the nation of Taiwan.
Well, yes, I know the history, but I don't think it's an overstatement to say it was created by the United States. Keep going.
Well, meaning, like, financially, when it became...
All right, keep going. Keep
Taiwan.
Going. South Korea.
South Korea and Israel. And it's,
well, Israel's also an oversimplification, but keep going.
And, there was a good... it was a very good deed done, wittingly or unwittingly.
All right, point.
Yeah, but for the people that needed a place to in Taiwan and South
All right,
Korea
point,
to
point,
get away
point,
from the
point,
communists.
Point. Point. Point.
Okay. Now the point is this: this country should create another country, and that they'd have to negotiate with Egypt to sell a.
All oh, right, the Palestinian homeland in the Sinai Desert. No. WBAI, you're on the air. Turn down your radio and speak up. I wish people would, like, pay attention to what we're talking about, okay? I posed some questions to the listeners, and I would like some answers, okay? So if you've got some other random, arbitrary rant, well, you know, this isn't the time and place for it. WBAI, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I've been better.
Okay. I'm going to make a comment, and I hope I don't offend anybody by saying this, but maybe it needs to be said. and I think I'm going to go ahead and say it.
Lay it on us.
I don't trust Obama.
Okay, why?
Because he's a nigger.
That's perfectly charming. And people wonder why I'm reluctant to take phone calls. WBAI, you're on the air. Hello.
Knucklehead.
Okay, I think maybe we'll go back to some Kenge Kenge. Maybe I'll just listen to myself ranting. WBAI, you're on the air.
Hey, how are you? You were asking the question of what was the difference between fundamental Islam and fascism?
Yeah.
And I got a, what's the difference between Lucifer or Satan? I think both oppress people.
Well, regardless. But hang on a minute. There are lots of systems out there which, and ideologies out there which oppress people.
Right.
But when people, you know, want to disparage one and portray it as the ultimate evil, they always say, oh, it's the new fascism, don't they?
Right.
So if we would do well to actually examine what it has in common with fascism and what it doesn't have in common with fascism.
But, you know, the funny thing to me in this country is that it goes through a lot of different phases, but ultimately it's a capitalist phase. I gather, and to keep people in competition with one another, ultimately.
Well, I mean,
and
what do you mean phase? Capitalism is not a phase.
I mean, you know, like the different ideas.
This country was founded on capitalism. It's not a phase.
Right, but no. I'm saying the democratic situation where people are supposedly free to do what they want, but they have to buy their right to be able to do it. I mean, that's not a democratic society per se. I think it's just a phase that, you know, the whole notion of...
I don't know what you mean by a phase. I mean, certainly I don't think that, you know...
Well, look what's going on now.
I don't think that, you know, bourgeois democracy is sufficiently democratic from the standpoint of actual human freedom.
No, but, you know, look at the things that's going on here now, for instance. You know, the notion that our freedoms, whatever they supposedly were, are being taken away from us when a lot of us in this country never experienced those particular freedoms before they were taken away.
Mm-hmm. All right. So you started out by lending credence to the notion of Islamo-fascism.
Well, now
you're dissing American democracy. So I'm a little confused. Where are you coming from and what do you have to say about what we've been discussing tonight?
I just kind of, you know what it is?
Are you an Obama booster or an Obama skeptic?
I'm to a point where I just think that whatever goes on is going to benefit people in power, and it's not going to benefit the people overall. You know, like, I'm coming into this conversation more or less, like, pessimistic about the world and what's going on.
Okay, but are you a little bit more optimistic now than you were 6 months ago?
No, it's gotten worse, especially since, like, for instance, in this city. With the way things are going now, legal aid is pulled out of family court, for instance. Like, there's no money in it.
Well, certainly the economic situation is much worse than it was.
Yeah, that's all. You know,
but in crisis, there's opportunity, as the cliche goes.
Yeah, you know, but I don't know. I just, you know, being labeled a minority in this country, you know, and that's another thing about it is that we're still being labeled by things that were invented to divide and conquer us anyway. So being a person in that regard, you know, I always had a pessimistic view on things. I haven't been around the nicer things in life, you know, having my radio stolen by cops, getting beat up by cops and not having the protection.
Well, look, there's no shortage of horror stories out there. We could sit around and tell horror stories all night.
I hope, I'm kind of like hoping that things will change. I hope maybe this guy Obama will be able to do something for us and at least change some of the situations, like the economic, for instance, help us to produce more work, produce jobs in this country. But then again, you know, the issue of having these other corporations leaving the country because they don't want to pay us a decent wage to live here, you know, that's another issue in itself. So at a certain point,
sort of the same issue. I mean, that was what
ultimately I was thinking was, is that everything we're talking about here probably has been talked about for so long, and it almost seems like an invented, unresolvable issue that's taking place here, and that's how I see it. you know, like we're all being Machiavelli to believe and hypnotically suggested, whatever we want to use the term. I think ultimately we're always going to be used by governments and politicians and or what have you, because there was something you even said, a politician is biased. They're going to have a biased opinion and a view.
I don't hold up, you know, objectivity as some kind of ideal. I mean, maybe in journalism and science, but certainly not in the realm of politics. I mean, subjectivity is completely appropriate there.
No, I'm not saying that, but
not. It, I mean, in terms of propaganda.
No, it's just a side issue. You know, people, like if you have, like for instance, you know, it's like the same old usual thing. You have people who protest about a certain area that corporations want to grab hold to. Ultimately, the corporations win. Because the politicians wind up siding with them. Meanwhile, we voted them in. Even now with the Bloomberg thing, I think that's insulting. And
it is. It's also not what we're talking about, though.
I understand. But it just, to me, it's all in the context of these people. They do what they want to do when they want to do it.
Who are these people?
The people in power, the politicians, the corporations. They all do what they want to do.
That at the moment, okay, they're suffering under certain material constraints, shall we say. Thanks for your call. Let's see who else is out there. WBAI, you're on the air. WBAI, you're on the air.
Good
evening,
Bill.
Hi.
I'm an Obama booster.
An Obama booster. Lay it on us.
Well, it's the, he says, we're the change we've been waiting for.
So okay, when was the make the case. That's just a slogan. Make the case.
Well, the case is that it's up to us now to step up to the plate, as a lot of us have been doing for, seems like our lifetime.
All right, so how do we do that now? How do you see that working? When we're not protesting the government, but, or at least not, you know, wholesale protesting the government as we were under Bush, but you see that there's actually some potentialities. I assume if you're an Obama booster, how do we step up to the plate? What form does that take?
Well, whether it's the local Democratic clubs and the groups that are interactive with them, you know, I'm in the Green Party, but I was a Democrat way back when. And, you know, it's just networking. It's just the people coming together. We the people. Grassroots. Whether it takes us walking, you know, going, doing something at the UN every Saturday individually or in, by the millions. You know, it's a slow, steady, slog back. But, you know, whose country? Our country.
Yep, as the song said. As the song said, all right, so you think that, yes, there are potentialities for some real change now that didn't
more than
exist.
More than I've seen in my lifetime.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, okay, Bill.
All right. Yeah. WBAI, you're on the air.
Okay.
Turn down your radio and speak up, please.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
How are you doing, my dear brother?
Okay. A little better now.
The first person that spoke about Ron Paul.
Yeah, yeah.
I think he's a very honorable and decent man. I'm a black person.
Mm-hmm.
But color is not an issue. Let's be very clear on that. Because there's only one race. That's the human race.
Mm.
Now,
I'm not sure what that has to do with Ron Paul. But.
No, well, the caller you were talking to just now. Now, let me say something. Someone that is critical of America doesn't mean that he's unpatriotic. Let's be very clear on that.
Mm.
One who criticizes the evil of any nation is the one that saved the life that nation. Example, Martin Luther King was one of them. Malcolm X was one of them. Today, we name streets and buildings after these people. It's not that they're unpatriotic. So the evil that those in power are doing and those who don't go along to get along is Rush Limbaugh, for example, he's saying he hopes Obama fails. That's a terrorist. Because we all love this station. You hear something?
I'm sorry. I missed you there. Can you say that again?
Rush Limbaugh, he made a statement that he hoped.
Oh,
that
yes.
Mm-hmm. Policies. Mm-hmm. Now, if Obama does not succeed, that means we're all going to suffer. This country is in a very terrible economic position.
Yes.
We're all suffering. So anybody that could fix this and make it a better country for us and the world is really a true patriot. Let's be very, very clear on that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Okay.
Now, the question you asked about, posed about Islam and fascism, okay? What about Judaism and terrorism?
Yeah.
What about Christianity and terrorism?
Of course.
Wait, hold on. Let's not forget the Inquisition.
Well, obviously.
So we cannot speak on point at this. Let's look at all of them.
Well, hang on a second. I didn't say that there was any kind of parallel between Islam and fascism. I did not say that.
What did you say?
There's a parallel between the jihad, Islamist militancy, whatever you want to call it, Islamic fundamentalism, whatever you want to call it. There's a parallel between that and fascism. Just as there's a parallel between this, the kind of extreme Zionism that we've seen manifested in the last few weeks in the bombardment of Gaza. There's a parallel between that and fascism, too.
Well, isn't the same thing about Christian right and Mr. Bush? And
yes, I made that point. Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes, I agree with you.
Yeah,
I agree with you.
Before we begin to attack, you see, speaking from a black perspective, we who are Christians, not one of us should claim his Christianity. Speaking from a black, and it's in its historical context. You see what I'm saying?
Okay, why?
Wait. Knowing the history of the Inquisition.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Knowing that. I'm not attacking Christianity. Christianity is a beautiful religion. By those who practice it in its truest sense.
Okay, well, look, I don't think we disagree about anything. So I'm going to see if we can squeeze in another call in the 3 minutes remaining to us. So thank you very much. Okay.
Bye-bye. Peace.
Good night. WBAI, you're on the air real quick.
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
I'm calling because I have a bit of like a concern and apprehension. I mean, I'm an Obama skeptic. And I've been watching, everything, unfolding since Obama's been elected to the time he got sworn in, and how the attitude of the people in the country are towards him, and how the media has been portraying him. I mean, in the Sunday newspaper, you see a picture of Obama, and then on the other side, you see Martin Luther King. And here they are comparing his wife to Jackie O. And I feel like, he hasn't done anything yet. Like, my children are coming home saying, Obama's a great man. I'm, like, thinking to myself, he hasn't done anything yet.
Well, he's only been in office for a week, and, in fact, he has done some things, as we talked about at the beginning of the show, both for good and for bad.
Well, I don't know. I feel like I have, like, a bit of concern there, because I see all the, so many people, like, supporting him, and I'm like, is this turning into blind nationalism? I mean, here we have all the corporations being bought out by the government, and now if this turns into some sort of blind nationalism, wouldn't that be the fertile ground for fascism?
Certainly the potential is there, but also, I mean, the corporations being bought out by the government could also be a first step towards socialism.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. I mean, traditionally the left has supported, the nationalization of the banks and industry and so on.
Well, it's a concern I have. Like, I hear my kids and I watch the people, and I don't know, it just worries me because I'm like, let's not get caught up. I mean, this could easily turn into fascism. I mean, with the government buying out all the big corporations, the bank Fannie Mae,
Well, it could turn into a sort of a same kind of merging of, big corporate power and the militarized state, such as defined classical fascism. But it could also be the beginning of the appropriation of private resources in the direction of the public good. It could also become a first step towards something like socialism. And I don't mean, some kind of twisted fascistic pseudo-socialism or national socialism. I mean, socialism as it's perceived from those of us on the left. Maybe.
Yeah, well, that's just my concern.
All right.
That's something that I'm, always, watching.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.